Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today is Roma Tiern, a Sri Lankan-born artist and writer who sprang to attention when her first novel, Mosquito, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award. Her third, Brixton Beach, is just out. It features a family that is torn apart both emotionally and geographically by civil war. Welcome, Roma. Could you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes. The novel starts off in Sri Lanka. It's about a mixed-race family. The mother is Sinhalese and the father is Tamil, and the little girl called Alice is mixed and therefore has considerable problems in school. The family emigrate to Britain, where they try very hard to integrate. And the whole of it is really with the background of the civil war in Sri Lanka.
Now, just to give a bit of a flavour of the writing, Roma's going to read a little bit from early on in the book. Could you just give us the immediate context for this?
Yes, the novel opens with the little girl Alice Fonseca, who is just about to have a birthday, and her mother Sita is expecting a baby. Only the young can feel this way. Unaware of time's passage, only they can be so trusting. It is their good fortune to live without question, storing up memories for that later day when middle age allows them to revisit the past. Time, of course, will change things. Time will mould and distort, lie and trick them with all its inconsistencies. But in the brief interlude, suspended between dreaming and waking, before the low door of childhood swings shut behind them forever, the young, with luck, can experience complete happiness. On the night before Alice Fonseca's 9th birthday, her father, Stanley, brought home 2 bright red apples. Stanley worked at a factory that imported all the foreign fruit for the rich cinnamon garden Sinhalese who could afford to live like the English. Apples are a luxury, Stanley told her. But because it's your 9th birthday, you must experience the taste of luxury. He smiled without joy, being preoccupied with things other than his daughter's birthday. Tomorrow, Alice's mother, Sita, planned to take Alice up the coast after school to stay with her grandparents for the weekend. The baby Sita was expecting was due in a month, and Alice's trip to her parents was partly to give Sita a chance to rest. But you can only stay for 2 nights, she warned Alice, peeling the apple and cutting it into segments. The flesh was pale and spongy. Alice ate it reluctantly. Why? She demanded. Why can't I stay longer? 2 nights, her mother said firmly. Finish your apple now and get ready for bed. You've got school in the morning. Alice scowled. She was not the slightest bit sleepy. I want to stay for a week. Visiting her grandparents was the best part of any birthday. Will Grandpa B meet us at the station? Yes, he will. Now be good and get ready for bed. It will make your birthday come sooner. Oh, I can't wait to see him, Alice cried, slipping off her chair and running round the satinwood dining table excitedly. Sita ate the leftover piece of apple. As a small child, Sita had nicknamed her father B. She no longer remembered her reason for this, but the name had stuck, and now everyone called him B, even his wife Kamala. The next day, when Sita collected Alice after school, she brought the remaining apple with her, packed carefully between her daughter's overnight clothes in her blue plastic visiting bag. You can share it with Grandpa B if you like, she said, when she met her. Alice nodded, her eyes shining. She had been too excited to sleep last night, but although she was tired, happiness rose in her like the spray from the sea. It was midday. The church clock was striking the hour. Children swarmed out of the school gate, dressed in the starched, immaculate white uniforms of St. Clair's College. The girls had neatly plaited, coconut-oiled hair. The boys wore gleaming shoes. Only her daughter, it seemed to Sita's critical eye, looked as though she had been rolling in the scrub again. "Annie, Alice, how did you become so filthy? Have you been sitting in the dirt again? And just look at your hair!" The child's hair, carefully plaited that morning, had come undone. There were bits of twig stuck in it, and her uniform was streaked with paint. "You've been climbing the trees again, haven't you?" Sita asked in exasperation.
her daughter's knees were covered in cuts. Alice hopped from one foot to the other, ignoring her mother. "I'll never be 8 again," she shouted at some of the children rushing past, waving at them. She was carrying a paper bag with presents from her classmates. "Can we go now, Mama?" she cried, dancing about and rubbing her already filthy shoes deeper into the red earth. Sita sighed. The year was 1973, and with every birthday her daughter seemed to be becoming more of a tomboy. Mrs. Pierce, the teacher, came out to talk to them. She stood in the boiling heat just outside the gate in the road where the beggars were gathered, close to the women selling spice, amberella and mango sambals, close to the palmist, chalking up sherbet pink marks on the ground. Mrs. Pierce hardly noticed the noise and the confusion that cartwheeled around her. She was glad to get out of school for a moment, she told Sita. But Alice saw her teacher look nervously over her shoulder, as though she expected someone, the headmaster perhaps, to come out and tick her off. Several mothers collecting their children looked curiously in their direction. It was unusual for a member of staff to talk to a parent in this informal way outside the classroom. The tight security since the bomb had gone off made it difficult to be as free and easy as in the old days.
Thank you very much. Now, I remember growing up in Africa what imported apples were like. There's obviously an autobiographical element in this.
Yes, there is, I'm afraid. My father spent a great deal of money bringing apples home on special occasions, and I hated them.
But it's part of the sort of post-colonial experience,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
So how autobiographical is the novel?
Well, in the very early chapter, something happens to Sita, and it's an incident that actually happened to my own mother.
That's the mother, that's Alice's mother.
Alice's mother, yes. And my own mother, when this horrendous thing happened to her, she actually said to me as a 9-year-old child, "Nobody will ever believe this has happened and nobody will ever find out." And it's rather lovely for me that over 40 years later, the story is aired.
And it's this awful thing that happens to her is to do with the violence meted out on the individual by political discord, isn't it?
Yes. Sita is a Sinhalese woman. Her husband is a Tamil. And obviously the name that she's pregnant and the name she has on her card, on her prenatal card, is a Tamil name. And the doctor who treats her doesn't want any more Tamil children in the world.
So there's quite a lot of shocking stuff in this novel.
Yes, yes there is. I mean, what interests me, I suppose, is that the war is now talked about in terms of something that has happened very recently. But in the late 50s, the trouble had already started. And in 1958, I was a little girl of 4 and I actually saw a man having petrol poured on him and set fire to. So it was going on then, really. Mm.
Now, half of the novel takes place in Sri Lanka. It's quite heavenly, the island, isn't it? Apart from these awful things that are happening around the edge.
Yes.
And then suddenly they're moved to London and to Brixton Beach. Tell us what the significance of the title is.
Okay, well, Brixton Beach is a house. And Alice, who spent her early years within yards of the Indian Ocean, running on it, swimming in it, learning to ride her bicycle on the sands, suddenly cannot get over the greyness of Brixton. And later on, she calls her house in Brixton, Brixton Beach.
And the move to London actually fractures the family.
Yes, it does, very much so. And that's also something that I experienced very, very strongly as a child, because the time difference, only 5 hours, but in those days there was no internet, and the time distance makes it impossible to connect.
So Alice loses her beloved grandfather.
Yes, she does. And she also, Sita and her husband split because they can't carry on with their relationship after what has happened to Sita. And in this new liberated world that they're now moving in, and all of that can't be translated back to Sri Lanka.
Her father, Stanley, is not entirely sympathetic, is he?
No, I didn't want a sort of good and bad. I wanted I wanted a Tamil who was human and who had human failings. And in my own experience, my father's family, who were Tamil, were very hostile towards my mother's family as Sinhalese. So the war is a very complicated business. And both sides have got problems.
And of course, her mother falls apart.
Yes. Yes, she does. She loses her entire identity. And she loses her language, which is very important to her. And she can't really integrate with the British.
Mm. But Alice does.
Alice does. Being younger, it's so much easier for a young child to go into an alien culture and just be part of it. Mm. Through school, really.
And this was your own experience.
It was, I'm afraid. This was an autobiographical bit because I just love London.
Although you now live in Oxford.
And now I live in Oxford, yes. But I still miss London very much.
Now, as well as being a writer, you work as an artist, as indeed does Alice. What sort of art do you do?
Well, I trained as a painter. I've been a painter for over 25 years. I also make small films and I do installation work. I trained at the Ruskin in Oxford. And I suppose my first love is for paints and visually. And so I suppose the novels always come from some imagery that I've been working with.
And the imagery is very important, actually, in the novels, isn't it? You talk about parrot blue skies and also
yes.
Musical imagery as well. Are you a musician as well?
Well, I used to play the piano and I listen to music all the time while I write. So the two things really feed the writing.
But there's something more to it than that, isn't there? Which is that art is redemptive in, well, certainly in Bone China and in this novel.
Yes, I think that if you have a country that removes the art, either through censorship or through preoccupation with violence, which is the case in Sri Lanka, I think you're taking the soul out of a country. And having worked with refugees myself, having taught art to refugees, I am utterly moved at the way damaged people coming from war-torn zones want to create through art, through either visual art or through writing. And as I work in both spheres, I work a lot with found photographs and accessing narratives through that.
What do you mean by found photographs?
I lost all my own family photographs apart from four, so I only have one image of my mother left. And so I have, since the time I lost these images, I have constantly gone to markets and flea markets and junk shops, really, looking for images of people. And I suppose subconsciously I'm looking for the ones I lost, which I will never find, of course. And looking at these images that come out of house clearances, all the people are dead, and trying to access the stories behind them.
And this is useful also for the immigrants that you work with?
Absolutely. I mean, quite often, some of the people I've worked with from Eastern Europe, they've escaped with one photograph. And this photograph is not just of that person. It carries memory of other events.
Now, how does this relate to the driftwood that Alice works with?
Well, the driftwood is, it's the tactile feel to it. It's the holding of something that's been in the sea. And the sea and water are traditionally considered areas that carry memory. And the driftwood has touched the seas.
Yes, I can see. So memory is absolutely one of the central themes of this novel,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself to be a political writer?
Not really, but I think that politics comes into every aspect of life. So I suppose in that sense I am, but I'm more interested in character and I'm terribly interested in language and how language can produce emotions by the use of it and by the withholding of it.
But nevertheless, all your three novels are directly bound up with the affairs in Sri Lanka.
Yes, yes they are. My fourth novel, which I'm working on now, moves away slightly from Sri Lanka and becomes more universal. But I do think the politics colours everything that we do.
And that there's a violence, isn't there, that we said before, a sort of political
yes.
violence that that repeats itself in personal life.
Yes.
Are there themes that you think are better tackled in art than in fiction?
Well, certainly colour is much more direct, and visually you can create a portrait of somebody very directly. But No, I don't think so. I think it's just a different way of working with a different medium. I mean, I had a very funny moment when I went to see an old tutor of mine at the Ruskin, and I said to him, I'm actually trying to write a novel and I feel a bit embarrassed about this and I'm not telling anybody. And he just looked at me and he said, just make the work, use whatever tool you need. So I think that's really what it's about for me.
Well, that's a very good motto for life, really, isn't
yes.
it? Last month, the president of Sri Lanka announced the defeat of the Tamil Tigers, didn't he?
He did, yes.
Do you believe that?
No, absolutely not. Memory does not die easily. There has to be truth and reconciliation. There has to be a uniting of the Tamils and the Sinhalese who live outside of the country. There has to be some unity between them. And there has to be investigations into the war crimes. Otherwise, there will never be peace.
And it's interesting, actually, that another theme in this book is the diaspora, the political importance of the diaspora.
Yes.
Actually, there are probably more Tamils outside than there are inside now.
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. But there are a significant amount of Sinhalese. And the war is continuing abroad because the Tamils and the Sinhalese, and especially the Sinhalese abroad, are embarrassed by what's going on in their country. So they're in denial. And actually, there has to be an openness and a willingness to discuss what is going on there. Because with 100,000 people dead, people are not going to forget. Women are not going to forget that their babies have died. Something has to be done with this emotion before there can be peace.
Roma, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.